File 60.
Chapter 11. Nation and Race. There are certain truths which stand out so openly on the roadsides of life, as it were, that every passer-by may see them. Yet because of their very obviousness, the general run of people disregard such truths, or at least they do not make them the object of any conscious knowledge. People are so blind to some of the simplest facts in everyday life that they are highly surprised when somebody calls attention to what everybody ought to know. Examples of the Columbus egg lie around us in hundreds of thousands, but observers like Columbus are rare. Walking about in the garden of nature, most men have the self-conceit to think that they know everything, yet almost all are blind to one of the most outstanding principles that nature employs in her work. This principle may be called the inner isolation, which characterizes each and every living species on this earth. Even a superficial glance is sufficient to show that all the innumerable forms in which the life urge of nature manifests itself are subject to a fundamental law. One may call it an iron law of nature, which compels the various species to keep within the definite limits of their own life forms when propagating and multiplying their kind. Each animal mates only with one of its own species. The titmouse cohabits only with the titmouse, the finch with the finch, the stork with the stork, the field mouse with the field mouse, the house mouse with the house mouse, the wolf with the she-wolf, etc. Deviations from this law take place only in exceptional circumstances. This happens especially under the compulsion of captivity, or when some other obstacle makes procreative intercourse impossible between individuals of the same species. But then nature abhors such intercourse with all her might, and her protest is most clearly demonstrated by the fact that the hybrid is either sterile or the fecundity of its descendants is limited. In most cases, hybrids and their progeny are denied the ordinary powers of resistance to disease or the natural means of defence against outer attack. Such a dispensation of nature is quite logical. Every crossing between two breeds, which are not quite equal, results in a product which holds an intermediate place between the levels of the two parents. This means that the offspring will indeed be superior to the parent which stands in the biologically lower order of being, but not so high as the higher parent. For this reason, it must eventually succumb in any struggle against the higher species. Such mating contradicts the will of nature towards the selective improvements of life in general. The favourable preliminary to this improvement is not to mate individuals of higher and lower orders of being, but rather to allow the complete triumph of the higher order. The stronger must dominate and not mate with the weaker, which would signify the sacrifice of its own higher nature. Only the born weakling can look upon this principle as cruel, and if he does so, it is merely because he is of a feebler nature and narrower mind. For if such a law did not direct the process of evolution, then the higher development of organic life would not be conceivable at all. This urge for the maintenance of the unmixed breed, which is a phenomenon that prevails throughout the whole of the natural world, results not only in the sharply defined outward distinction between one species and another, but also in the internal similarity of characteristic qualities which are peculiar to each breed or species. The fox remains always a fox. The goose remains a goose. And the tiger will retain the character of a tiger. The only difference that can exist within the species must be in the various degrees of structural strength and active power, in the intelligence, efficiency, endurance, etc., with which the individual specimens are endowed. It would be impossible to find a fox which has a kindly and protective disposition towards geese, just as no cat exists which has a friendly disposition towards mice. That is why the struggle between the various species does not arise from a feeling of mutual antipathy, but from hunger and love. In both cases, nature looks on calmly and is even pleased with what happens. The struggle for the daily livelihood leaves behind in the ruck everything that is weak or diseased or wavering, while the fight of the male to possess the female gives to the strongest the right, or at least the possibility, to propagate its kind. And this struggle is a means of furthering the health and powers of resistance in the species. Thus it is one of the causes underlying the process of development towards a higher quality of being. If the case were different, the progressive process would cease, and even retrogression might set in. Since the inferior always outnumber the superior, the former would always increase more rapidly if they possessed the same capacities for survival and for the procreation of their kind. And the final consequence would be that the best in quality would be forced to recede into the background. Therefore, a corrective measure in favour of the better quality must intervene. Nature supplies this by establishing rigorous conditions of life to which the weaker will have to submit, and will thereby be numerically restricted. But even that portion which survives cannot indiscriminately multiply, for here a new and rigorous selection takes place according to strength and health. If nature does not wish that weaker individuals should mate with the stronger, she wishes even less that a superior race should intermingle with an inferior one, because in such a case all her efforts throughout hundreds of thousands of years to establish an evolutionary higher stage of being may thus be rendered futile. History furnishes us with innumerable instances that prove this law. It shows, with startling clarity, that whenever Aryans have mingled their blood with that of an inferior race, the result has been the downfall of the people who were the standard-bearers of a higher culture. In North America, where the population is prevalently Teutonic, and where those elements intermingled with the inferior race only to a very small degree, we have a quality of mankind and a civilization which are different from those of Central and South America. In these latter countries, the immigrants, who mainly belonged to the Latin races, mated with the Aborigines, sometimes to a very large extent indeed. In this case, we have a clear and decisive example of the effect produced by the mixture of races. But in North America, the Teutonic element, which has kept its racial stock pure and did not mix it with any other racial stock, has come to dominate the American continent and will remain master of it as long as that element does not fall a victim to the habit of adulterating its blood. In short, the results of miscegenation are always the following. A. The level of the superior race becomes lowered. B. Physical and mental degeneration sets in, thus leading slowly but steadily towards a progressive drying up of the vital sap. The act which brings about such a development is a sin against the will of the eternal Creator, and as a sin this act will be avenged. Man's effort to build up something that contradicts the iron logic of nature brings him into conflict with those principles to which he himself exclusively owes his own existence. By acting against the laws of nature, he prepares the way that leads to his ruin. Here we meet the insolent objection, which is Jewish in its inspiration and is typical of the modern pacifist. It says, man can control even nature. There are millions who repeat by rote that piece of Jewish babble, and end up by imagining that somehow they are themselves the conquerors of nature. And yet their only weapon is just a mere idea, and a very preposterous idea into the bargain, because if one accepted it, then it would be impossible even to imagine the existence of the world. The real truth is that not only has man failed to overcome nature in any sphere whatsoever, but that at best he has merely succeeded in getting hold of and lifting a tiny corner of the enormous veil which she has spread over her eternal mysteries and secret. He never creates anything. All he can do is to discover something. He does not master nature, but has only come to be master of those living beings who have not gained the knowledge he has arrived at by penetrating into some of nature's laws and mysteries. Apart from all this, an idea can never subject to its own sway those conditions which are necessary for the existence and development of mankind. For the idea itself has come only from man. Without man, there would be no human idea in this world. The idea as such is therefore always dependent on the existence of man, and consequently is dependent on those laws which furnish the conditions of his existence. And not only that, certain ideas are even confined to certain people. This holds true with regard to those ideas in particular which have not their roots in objective scientific truth, but in the world of feeling. In other words, to use a phrase which is current today and which well and clearly expresses this truth, they reflect an inner experience. All such ideas, which have nothing to do with cold logic as such, but represent mere manifestations of feeling, such as ethical and moral conceptions, etc., are inextricably bound up with man's existence. It is to the creative powers of man's imagination that such ideas owe their existence. Now then, a necessary condition for the maintenance of such ideas is the existence of certain races and certain types of men. For example, anyone who sincerely wishes that the pacifist idea should prevail in this world ought to do all he is capable of doing to help the Germans conquer the world, for in case the reverse should happen, it may easily be that the last pacifist would disappear with the last German. I say this because, unfortunately, only our people, and no other people in the world, fell a prey to this idea. Whether you like it or not, You would have to make up your mind to forget wars if you would achieve the pacifist ideal. Nothing less than this was the plan of the American world redeemer, Woodrow Wilson. Anyhow, that was what our visionaries believed, and they thought that through his plans their ideals would be attained.